It's 1959, and Lamar Hunt has been busy launching this new football league. And in the midst of doing all these things, meeting with other owners, working on TV deals, he realizes he needs to hire a head coach. His first choice is the Oklahoma legend Bud Wilkinson, who he courted strenuously. Lamar also interviewed Tom Landry, who was then an assistant for the Giants. But Landry was very skeptical about whether the AFL would get off the ground. I think it was coming back after the last interview with Wilkinson that one of Lamar's friends mentioned to him again, Hank Stram.
Lamar Hunt first came to know Hank Stram in the fall of 1956 while attending a game at his alma mater, SMU. Hank was a bright but relatively unknown assistant coach at the time, a little older than the young Lamar. His journey in football had started years earlier as a star halfback at Purdue and had carried him through the coaching ranks to the University of Miami in 1959.
He loved the camaraderie of being around a team. Coaching enabled him to take advantage of all the skills that he had, and all of those experiences and all those places really helped define the kind of coach that he was going to be.
The two were sort of this perfectly mismatched pair. Lamar was a wealthy man who had just none of the typical trappings of wealth, whereas Hank was very concerned about his appearance, very concerned about the image he projected. But the two both loved football. The two were both very competitive, and they hit it off. They were sort of twin architects building this new franchise.
Every championship blueprint begins in the same place, a great quarterback. And every young coach is looking for his star quarterback. Most failed head coaches never found theirs. It turns out, Hank already knew his.
Well, I first met Hank Stram when I was a senior in high school back in Lawrence, Ohio, at Purdue University. He was an assistant coach there, and he worked very closely with the quarterbacks.
Hank knew what Len Dawson was capable of. He was an All-American and a top draft choice. He also knew that for whatever reason, Dawson had been languishing on the benches of NFL teams for the past five seasons.
I was drafted by Pittsburgh. Was there 3 years, got traded to Cleveland, was there 2 years, and didn't get an opportunity to play. Hank Stram was in Pittsburgh, where I was living at the time, and he said, "Geez, Lenny, if you ever get free, let me know. I'd love to have you on our team." Paul Brown was the coach of the Cleveland Browns, and I asked him to put me on waivers because I hadn't played, and he did.
Once Len got there, he will be the first to tell you that he shocked and disappointed Hank Stram. He had gotten very sloppy in his fundamentals, not only his throwing motion, but also his footwork.
In his mind's eye, he was always, you know, that great quarterback at Purdue, and thought that he would just step right back in there. But, I mean, he had gotten rusty. And when he first got in there, Dad talked to him, "Hey, man, I might have made a mistake."
It happens all the time. You look at players who are successful for one team and then aren't for another. But I think that success is predicated on the trust that they have for each other. That was always unwavering with my father. He always believed in Lenny.
That training camp in 62 was an example of Hank Stram at his best, because he didn't just give up on Dawson. He worked with him every day after practice, worked on his fundamentals, worked on his footwork. And by the end of training camp, Dawson was the quarterback of the future.
Hank's trust paid off. In Dawson's first year with the team, the Texans' offense was unstoppable, leading the AFL in scoring en route to an 11-3 record. Dawson finished with a league-best 27 touchdown passes, and the Texans made it all the way to the AFL championship game.
The big rush is on, the kick is up, the kick is good. Dallas is the champion.
Here's Hank Stram, the coach of the now champion Dallas Texans. And Hank, congratulations.
Thank you very much, Jack. It's a great thrill, and I just can't compliment this squad enough to see the way they came back and stayed in the ballgame in the second half like they did and finally came back and won it. It was a great tribute, I think, to our squad.
In only their third year, the triumphant Texans brought a championship to Dallas. But the instability of the still-fledgling American Football League affected all of its teams. even its champions.
Hank called me and said, Leonard, I know you're thinking about moving out to Dallas. You might want to hold off on that for a little bit.
Chiefs Kingdom is brought to you by Farmland, passion for pork since 1959. Bud Light, the sure sign of a good time, here we go. And the University of Kansas Hospital, the official health care provider of the Chiefs. Despite the unexpected departure from Dallas, Hank Stram's team found a home in Kansas City.
Let me have your attention.
He was just a very personable guy. And there were coaches like that, but they weren't usually successful. And it was the Lombardis and the Paul Browns and the really tough guys that could last. Hank Stram was nothing like Paul Brown.
You got cleats on your shoes?
No.
Geez, you look like you got bedroom slippers on.
Emery was not an introvert by any shades of imagination. He had a sense of humor.
Move back a little bit, man. Move back. You're suffocating everybody here. Hurry back, hurry back, hurry back. They're making that turn like they got ice skates on.
Hank was different than a lot of coaches in that time period. He was, he's very dapper. Thought more about his attire on game day than some coaches.
If you saw him on the sideline, he's like somebody drew him on a piece of paper. Everything is in place.
We called him Dapper Dan because he always dressed immaculate. And you see the other coaches, they didn't have no tie on or anything.
I remember many a times Dad would say, come on, kids, you want to go take a ride? Sure. We pull up into this place downtown Kansas City, and we'll sit in a fire zone while Dad's looking at fabrics and stuff, and they're measuring them for a suit. We're in there for about 3 hours in the car and then double parked there.
He also made the team. Everybody dressed. We all had these outfits.
We look like the boys in the band or something like that when we go on the road.
We really felt that dress was part of presentation. You were acknowledging to others how you felt about yourself. And it was something that I think we fully embraced because just because you played professional football did not mean that you were going to be less than presentable.
And that was his thing. You look sharp, you play that way.
Hank's three-piece suits and double-breasted overcoats certainly stood out among common NFL sideline attire of the 1960s. But compared to the old guard NFL, it may have been his offensive philosophy that was most radical.
The mid-60s was a time when Vince Lombardi and the Packers' ethic was dominant. And that ethic was, we're not going to try to trick you. We are not going to try to hide what we're going to do. We have a handful of plays, and they are sound and fundamentally solid. And what we will do is we will execute those plays, the power sweep foremost among them, better than any other team in football. We're coming at you. Try to stop us. You're not going to be able to. That was the NFL mindset. Hank came from a different place.
This is our playbook, and it's divided into three chapters. Now, the final chapter is on strategy and tactics. Each play and each pattern is a precise movement. It must be studied, understood, and then executed properly on the field.
Hank recognized that in pro football, where the talent level of so many teams was similar, the difference was going to be requiring defenses to think. And in that split second, that moment of uncertainty, that's when Hank would find the opening.
Those great teams in Kansas City, they did some things different. I think the first time I remember anybody putting their tight end in the backfield, the triple eye, a lot of motion, a lot of shifting, trying to make the defense prepare for a lot of things.
In terms of the raw X's and O's, he was as detailed probably as any human being that I'd ever been around.
We were well educated as far as what the teams were going to do week in and week out. He even gave us tests on the plane to
to make sure that we knew our assignments.
This guy is so loose over here, Lenny. You can throw there anytime you want. Throw a hitch right off the bat. Throw a hitch right off the bat to Riddler.
He was out in front of everybody else. He's always wanted to try something new.
Nice going there, Riddler. Yes, sir.
You know, he didn't just go by the book and what everybody else was doing. If there was a better way to do things, he was going to try to find a way to do that.
He did a lot of things. Even at the time when we were having difficulty winning games, he even brought in a psychologist.
He tried to one time coach a game from the coach's tower that he would have for practices. Hank actually tried to coach a game once, and it didn't go well.
We would line Otis Taylor up between guard and center at different times. We would run combinations of plays that I think some teams don't even run today.
Beautiful. One time, you know, he said, hey, you know, today we're going to race the horse. I said, God almighty, give me a break. We're going to have a race with the horse? See who's the fastest. We actually beat it in the old stadium, beat the horse.
Hank is responsible for much of the offensive innovation that took place throughout the 1960s, and it showed. By the time the last AFL game was played in 1969, the Chiefs were the all-time AFL leaders in points scored and were second in total yards. The innovation that was possibly Hank's most lasting impact on the game was simple, but highly effective.
Most teams would be dropping straight back from the center about 7 yards deep to pass. Well, Hank decided, you know, why don't we move the pocket? Why do we always have to be right back there?
Our philosophy, move in the pocket. Make sure one time you roll right, you roll left, throw a play action pass.
What if there's a great defensive end to your right? Why not think about moving the pocket to the left?
Lenny takes the snap, he fakes the run, but he'll be back to throw. He does run deeper.
That was very successful for our football team. That's what we were known as, a team that would move the pocket.
You know, all these things that he was never afraid to do what he felt was best.
It seemed like everything about the Chiefs of the 1960s was different from the norm. Hank Stram embraced change, even when it was not always the most popular thing to do.
At a time in Texas in the early 60s where racism was routine and to a great deal unquestioned, you had two white men in positions of power who made it a point that this football team was going to be a meritocracy and decisions were not going to be made based on color.
We don't particularly care what color he is, what nationality, what anything. The only concern we have is bringing them in with the idea of competing for our squad, and if they earn the right to be a member of our 40-man squad, then they're going to be here.
He always said character was the main thing, and he found good character in a lot of us, as well as being good athletes, and he gave us a chance to play. He was willing, along with the owner, to let whoever was the best player play.
It didn't make any difference to Hank Stram what color your skin was. You know, it made a difference of how good a football player you were.
It was something that many were still not comfortable attempting to do. But Coach Stram had a view and vision that allowed him to look for excellence, to look at how you pieced it together, regardless of what others might have thought at that time.
And so you had a lot of these young players, many of them Texan, many of them who'd never interacted at all with African Americans, who were suddenly in this environment where they were teammates and had to share facilities, had to share a ladle from the jug of water on the sidelines. And Hank was very insistent that they learned how to do this.
By the fall of 1966, the landscape of professional football had seen a seismic shift. The two leagues were becoming one, and the war that had sent Hank's Texans to Kansas City was about to reach its pinnacle.
This match between the champs of the two leagues came about much sooner than anyone expected, but is here and is here to stay, and it's always the first one that seems to be the most remembered.
In the media and among most fans, there was a general belief that the AFL was inferior in terms of the coaching, the quality of the quarterbacks, the level of competition.
Everything around Super Bowl I was so hyped basically everybody was telling the Green Bay Packers, you don't win this game in a blowout, it says something about you.
Obviously, Hank, who was fairly thin-skinned to begin with, took that personally, as you would expect any proud coach to do.
And of course, that game was very close at halftime.
They had more yards gained, more first downs in the first half.
There was a real sense of the great Green Bay Packers, who had built this true dynasty, suddenly it all collapsing.
And then it all falls apart with the Dawson interception in the third quarter.
Lenny takes the snap, back to throw, going deeper in the pocket, he is right, throws a wobbler, and it's going to be intercepted.
And then word comes from one locker room to another that Lombardi, when pressed, has said, no, that the Chiefs aren't the best team he'd seen.
I think the Kansas City team is a real top football team, and it doesn't compare with the National Football League teams. That's what you want me to say, I said it.
Well, that was not very complimentary, and I know that Hank did not like that in the least.
The aftermath of that really fueled the Chiefs.
The place that I recognize the seriousness of the Chiefs and the Green Bay loss in Super Bowl I occurred in my rookie year when we played Chicago Bears in Kansas City.
It was the first NFL team that we played after losing Super Bowl I to the Green Bay Packers, and it was still gnawing at us.
Every AFL-NFL exhibition game at that time was just like another Super Bowl. They didn't want to lose to us little guys. We wanted to prove ourselves.
Hank, I believe, had shown the film or some excerpts from the Super Bowl, had discussed and talked about it, I believe, that week prior to the Chicago Bear game.
Hank wasn't about to lose another game to the NFL, I don't think so. And, of course, the old stadium in Kansas City is packed. And the Bears score first, march down the field, kick a field goal.
He runs the ball out of the 20, and they break it. He's gone.
One of those games where, you know, every time Lenny went back to throw a pass, I mean, it was a touchdown.
We put 66 points on the board.
The final score is 66-24.
I think it was Fred Arbanis was on the sideline. He said, let's put 100 points on the board against these people.
On the end-around play, the 40, at the 35, at the 30.
I thought, gosh, what's going on here? Only, you know, I'd always heard about Chicago Bears, how big and tough and rough they are. You know, there was Mike Dickey on the end, you know, supposed to be the meanest son of a gun around.
Mason in the backfield, Lenny takes the run, Dawson back to throw in the 40. He's throwing deep, Taylor's right.
This is an exhibition game. I know it didn't mean much, but heck, we wanted to show them what we had, and they, you know, we did.
That was the intensity between the NFL and the AFL in those days, and what it meant to us.
Sort of their revenge game against the NFL after an offseason of being laughed at.
It was as outstanding a performance I've ever seen, and I'm sure it really was one of making a statement. There was quality here, and that quality was going to have to be reckoned with at some point.
Chiefs Kingdom is brought to you by Farmland, passion for pork since 1959. Bud Light, the sure sign of a good time, here we go. And the University of Kansas Hospital, the official health care provider of the Chiefs. The Chiefs Kingdom is a symphony of moments, images, connections, and each snapshot tells a story of her adventure. Throughout his Hall of Fame career, Hank Stram was always looking for an edge. Whether it was the moving pocket or the triple stack, Hank kept his opponents guessing. And as they quickly found out, that didn't stop with X's and O's.
He talked to our competitor coaches, and remember one time before the Oakland games, Madden had a kind of a fetish about rats. He was scared of them. And Stram would be talking to Madden, and as like right before the game, he'd turn around and walk off and say, we also have a rat problem in the locker rooms. And they said Madden had everybody in the locker room when they went in, you know, before the game, checking their bags and looking for rats.
He has time to throw. He's firing one deep, wide open. Frank hits. He makes the catch.
You know, he would put a little something into him, getting worried about that instead of the game.
65 toss power trap.